ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Father Coughlin will address you this afternoon on the subject of unjust aggressors. This presentation is brought to you each Sunday at this same hour and is made possible through the moral and financial support which this audience extends to Father Coughlin. It is your program. As you are waiting for the Reverend Spokesman to come to the microphone, the Little Flower Choristers with Mr. Cyril Guthrell at the console of the organ will sing Filii et Filiae. Ladies and gentlemen, before presenting Father Coughlin, I am privileged to make the following announcement. A book containing the last 13 addresses given by Father Coughlin over this microphone is yours for the asking. Many thousands in this audience are planning to enter the Keep Out of War contest, sponsored by the Social Justice Publishing Corporation. It is a contest, or rather 9 simultaneous contests, designed not only for all children from the 5th through the 12th grades inclusive, but also for adults. Each contestant among the children will be classified in his own grade and will not be expected to compete against children in higher or lower grades. The free-for-all contest is designed for adults beyond high school age. A total of more than $16,000 in prizes will be awarded to at least 135 winners. Unquestionably, This information contained in the book which Father Coughlin is offering to give to everyone who writes to him will be valuable not only to all contestants, but to every person who is anxious to obtain information relative to the worldwide problem of war. When you are writing to Father Coughlin this week, will you kindly state your opinion if he should continue broadcasting throughout the summer months? He informs me that he is more than willing to serve you all summer long on the radio if it is your desire for him to do so. Your opinion and your letters will decide this question. During the course of this address, Father Coughlin will have occasion to mention the League for Peace and Democracy. This organization, through various spokesmen, and under the caption of Democracy Speaks, has seen fit to invite public criticism by reason of its recent broadcasts. Social Justice Magazine, quoting from official government records obtained by the Congress of the United States, will show that the League for Peace and Democracy was formerly known as the League Against War and Fascism. It will show that it is linked closely with the activities of communists in America and elsewhere. Once again, may I state that this information comes to us from official government documents. And now Father Coughlin is ready to address you on the subject of unjust aggressors. Father Coughlin.
Where can I obtain profitable work? Asks the laborer. How can I save my farm and sell the fruits of my toil at a profit? Questions the farmer. How is it possible to procure security for my children? Is the worry of every parent. My friends, these should be the questions of prime concern. Unfortunately, however, the mind of America is concentrated upon European affairs in general, and in particular, upon the stark probability of our engaging in war. That we are so inordinately concerned with Europe and its dictators, its aggressors, and its imperialistic plunderbunds is lamentable. It means that we have permitted ourselves to become putty in the hands of the propagandists. It means that we have forgotten why our ancestors fled from the unbearable hardships imposed upon them in England, Ireland, France, Poland, Germany, Italy, and every other country abroad. And possibly it means that we are losing our patriotic appreciation for those stalwart men who rallied round George Washington, who suffered at Valley Forge, who risked their lives to establish a new country with new ideals, independent of European intrigues and oppression. And above all, it means that we have permitted ourselves to be distracted from solving the problems of our national depression. Meanwhile, we grow very indignant at the mere mention of the phrase unjust aggressor, forgetting that 30 million Americans are victims of local aggressors. We wax very idealistic at the sound of the word democracy, forgetful that if we engage in a foreign war, there will be no more democracy. As a preface to the remarks I am about to make, let me state that no real American should extend any support or favor towards either Nazism or communism. These forms of government are totally foreign to our concept. Furthermore, insofar as we Americans do not profess the doctrines of imperialism, insofar as our nation was established in direct opposition to British imperialism, we entertain no fondness for that form of government. Consequently, even though President Roosevelt commendable peace efforts should fail, we are not prepared to assist Germany or Russia or imperialistic France and England in their European struggles. All of them have been unjust aggressors in the strict meaning of the word. None of them are democracies in the American meaning of the word. As for Germany and Soviet Russia, no one whose opinion is valued disputes the charge of unjust aggressor to these governments. As for Great Britain, all Americans are not in agreement. Many deny that Great Britain has been an unjust aggressor. Others affirm it. Permit me to remind you that Great Britain has been and is an unjust aggressor. As such, she is not deserving of the expenditure of one American boy's life. How did England acquire her far-flung colonies? By sword and conquest. As far back as the year 1172, nearly 800 years ago, Great Britain began to play the role of the unjust aggressor against Ireland. In the year 1795, when the Irish people endeavored to emulate what our founding fathers accomplished in 1776, history records that the English troops slaughtered 160,000 sons of Erin in the name of aggression. In 1916, and again in 1919, England sent her black and tan troops throughout Ireland to encroach upon the liberties of thousands and thousands of innocent, defenseless citizens who were deprived of their homes, their property, and oftentimes of their lives in the name of aggression. Almost to this present moment, Britain kept the yoke of oppression firmly fixed upon more than 3 million Irish people in the name of aggression. Following the seizure of Ireland, Scotland and Wales succumbed to the unjust aggressors operating from London. Territory after territory fell within the orbit of the British Empire, not through purchase, but through the force of arms. Until today, approximately one-fourth of the entire world is British-owned and British-dominated. And this is the empire which today is clamoring aloud about unjust aggression. An empire which is paraded before us as a democracy, an empire that insists upon others ceasing their unjust aggressions, while she still holds fast to India, to Egypt, to parts of Ireland, and to the unpaid billions of dollars which we loaned her. Not so long ago, Italy was thoroughly condemned for its unjust aggression against the Ethiopian people. No one in America defends the Italian policy in that instance. But how many of our excited population realize that in the year 1920, both the Imperial Republic of France, together with Imperial Britain, signed an agreement with Italy to encroach upon the territory of Ethiopia? The agreement read that if and when Ethiopia were conquered, the railroad leading from the capital of France, Somaliland, to the capital of Ethiopia was to be ceded to France, and that the territory around Lake Tana in Ethiopia was to be given Great Britain. Italy's share was the land itself. There, my friends, are the facts of the Ethiopian aggression, facts which indicate that Italy alone was not the unjust aggressor. Some Americans maintain that the United States is likewise an empire because of its aggressions in Cuba and the Philippines. Following 1898, what was our attitude towards Cuba? We expended men, money, and energy to modernize Cuba, at least in part. And the little island was restored to the people to whom it belonged. That was our identical attitude towards the people of the Philippines. Our democracy has never been an imperialism by which we won at the point of a bayonet vast territories and held them to exploit the people resident there for our own commercial benefit. What business have we Americans taking sides with such an unjust aggressor? Now that Britain fears the dissolution of her ill-gotten empire. As for Europe, it is still Europe. Its entire history has been a history of aggression. Following each hateful war, European diplomats gathered round the council chamber. The victors dictated a peace treaty, which the vanquished were forced to sign. A peace treaty which in every instance proved to be another scrap of paper. For not one international document terminating European wars has been honored by its signatories. Who therefore entertained the thought that the Treaty of Versailles would be honored by all its participants? Does not the vast majority of historians regard that treaty as an unjust document? Was not its chief objective the dismemberment of the German Empire? Did it not impose a fine of $57 billion payable in gold upon a penniless people from whose treasuries there had been removed the last ounce of gold? Did it not shackle the German people to the pillar of oppression when it virtually forbade them to trade with other nations? Did it not despoil Germany of all her colonies? And in a spirit of revenge and barbarism, instead of peace and humanity, was not the Treaty of Versailles instrumental in removing more than 1 million milk cows upon which depended the little children for their food? Certainly Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles because there was no alternative. A treaty that will go down in history as the most inhuman aggression ever committed against any people in the entire history of the civilized world. An aggression which was not aimed at the Kaiser and at those who were responsible for Germany's participation in the World War. A treaty that was not aimed at the international bankers who sent the Bolsheviks into Russia, but aimed at the poor, victimized people who remained behind when the malefactors had fled to safety. When we therefore become aroused at the mention of the word aggression, what aggression equals in its cruelty, its injustice, and its insanity, the aggression perpetrated by the Treaty of Versailles? The majority of historians recognized, even at the time of its composition, 20 years ago, that it was the breeding ground for more aggressions and for another war. 20 years have passed, and behold, those who were the unjust aggressors at the peace table of Versailles, particularly Britain and France, behold them. Now they are the loudest in advertising to the world the unjust aggressions of Germany and Italy. According to the theories of England and France, any nation which desires them to surrender their ill-gotten goods or to restore their ill-gotten colonies is an aggressor. The sacred status quo must not be disturbed, even though it runs foul of the law of self-preservation. There are other reasons which escape the notice of most persons, which explains why Europe has been a constant battleground throughout the centuries. Reasons explaining why the territory of Poland has been partitioned and repartitioned. Why Alsace-Lorraine has been an international football. Why the Balkans have been a constant powder keg of revolution. Why European nations for more than 200 years expended more money upon arms, munitions, and war than upon peace and prosperity. Consider these facts. The population of Europe comprises approximately 425 million persons. They are crammed into a little territory, practically equivalent in area to the states of Texas and Oklahoma combined. The majority of Europeans is forced to dwell upon land which is totally unproductive of many commodities such as cotton. Their struggle for life always has been a struggle which we Americans in no wise appreciate. We, with our vast expanse of territory, with our flowing fields of grain, with our well-equipped factories and sources of natural wealth. Is it any wonder that 425 million persons constantly cry for more territory, constantly demand expansion? Is it any wonder why the have-not nations constantly have had recourse to arms against the have nations, especially when unsound peace treaties and wicked programs of economy were conceived to starve the masses and prosper the few? Keeping these thoughts in mind, is it not evident that Europe's problems are primarily economic problems? The struggle impending in Europe today, therefore, is not based so much upon ideologies of government as it is upon economics. Positively, there can be no lasting settlement and peace for Europe until the European nations themselves are willing to break down the economic barriers by which the have nations impose economic restrictions upon the have-nots. What Englishman admits that 45 million inhabitants of his little island can subsist upon its lean, hard soil, which is devoid of many of nature's gifts? England could not manage. Therefore, she was forced to adopt the policy of imperialism, forced to build a navy and a merchant marine, forced, according to her philosophy, to exploit India, Australia, and South Africa for the maintenance of her own population. The same analysis holds good for Belgium, for Germany, for France, and for Italy. Russia alone, of all European nations, is nearly self-sustaining. I repeat, therefore, that the problem of peace in Europe is primarily an economic problem. It is impossible for 425 million people to subsist in contentment, penned up in quarters no larger than Texas and Oklahoma, and not one half so fertile and productive. That is the reason why every generation of Europe's have-not nations have risen up in protest against the subjugation imposed upon them by the victors in the previous wars. And that same reason will obtain as long as Europe is Europe, as long as the present economy predominates. For ages, the history of Europe has been a history of unjust aggression. Wherefore, the cry of unjust aggressor is nothing new. It was raised in the days of Kaiser Wilhelm II. It was on the lips of the Frenchman in the days of Napoleon Bonaparte. It was the same cry which impelled Charles V in the 14th century to reduce the peoples of Europe under his single sovereign rule. Being advised of this, why should we Americans of this generation be deceived by a catchword when it is so evident that Europe can never have peace as long as it protects its age-old economy of might and oppression, and as long as the economic destinies of Europe are wedded to gold? No wonder there is unrest in Europe today. Both Great Britain and France, who have dominated European trade for centuries, have insisted that commerce be carried on through the transfer of gold. The have-not nations, lacking gold, are compelled either to submit to their exploitation, or to starve, or to form alliances against their economic aggressors. Supposing the United States of America were divided into 48 nations. Supposing the people of Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska, where there is no gold, were forced to trade with the people of Illinois or Kentucky or New York on the basis of gold or else starve. Would they be content? That is absolutely the sentence imposed upon the majority of European nations today by France and England and the United States of America, in whose coffers 3/4 of the commercial gold of all the world is hidden. While Mussolini and Hitler are engaged in their recent territorial aggression, the financial aggression perpetrated by the gold hoarders in England and France and this country has done more to breed wars and unrest amongst European nations which lack gold and colonies than has any other factor. It is true we Americans do not like the dictatorial forms of government in Germany, in Italy, and elsewhere. We prefer our own democratic system. Nevertheless, it is time for us to recognize that the advertised opposition to the fascist nations is not so much related to the forms of government which they sustain as to the fact that the warmongers in America, in England, and in France are more concerned about the prospect of gold-lacking nations combining against the gold-hoarding nations. Opposition to them only because of their political ideologies is pure propaganda. Basically, the disturbances in Europe are more than political. They are economic and financial. Those who endeavor to tell us they are the only political are either unmindful of the facts which I've just cited, or are accomplices trying to deceive the American people to perpetuate the poverty, the exploitation, and the misery which an immoral system of finance and economy has foisted upon every nation of the old world. The same system, my friends, which fails to abolish the depression in the New World. If America goes to war, the outcome will be no different than that which followed the World War. All propaganda will advertise that we are virtuous in helping to save democracy. But the truth is that we are helping to perpetuate the power of the international bankers. since the year 1694, when the privately owned Bank of England was established, its owners gradually gained domination over the destinies of Europe and the monopoly of industry. But most importantly, this bank and the other central privately owned banks established gold as the single medium of international trade. And as a result, nations without gold were practically and economically outlawed. Always Great Britain has been successful in getting other people to fight her wars and protect the fruits of her age-old gold policy of aggression. Therefore, Great Britain will defend her possessions today and tomorrow until the last American doughboy is dead. It is almost ludicrous to find that we Americans are more anxious to engage in Europe's chronic wars to defend the status quo of iniquity and oppression than are our neighbors to the north in Canada. Our nation is a giant in territory compared to pygmy Europe. Our population is small compared to the large masses of people who are huddled together from Moscow to Madrid. Our natural resources are infinitely superior to those of the old land. Our constitutional form of government, our superior training in mechanics, and our executives are without doubt the finest in the modern world. Granting all that, we have 12 million men unemployed, 22 million on the dole, more than one-third of our population living below the bare standard of existence, and 16 billion gold dollars buried at Fort Knox, Kentucky. Now, shall we who will not use this money to rectify our economic conditions at home engage in a world war to starve out of existence those who have no gold abroad? Shall we be duped by the international bankers to preserve their status quo, which literally drains the lifeblood from India, from Africa, and from Australia to maintain an oligarchy of wealth in their palaces and force the masses to live in their hovels? Ladies and gentlemen, my criticism is in no wise leveled against the people of England and France, whom I deeply respect and with whom I sincerely sympathize. They, too, have been victimized by the oligarchs. It is intended only for those who have exploited them, together with the people of Europe and the people of our own country. All peoples want peace, but peace can come only with justice. And justice can flourish only when men and women of any country are permitted to live and earn their bread free from the artificial impediment of gold. If there needs be talk of war, therefore, let us organize our forces in America to make war upon this same oligarchy of gold, which has closed our factories, confiscated our farms, bred class hatred in the hearts of our citizens. Let us declare war on them first. But let us do it in a peaceful, American, intelligent, and democratic manner.
Oh, be not deceived by the mirage of glowing words which pictures the blessedness of social reform or the charity which begins abroad and closes its eyes to the charity which should begin at home. Be not deceived by the fictitious appeals to democracy which exists nowhere in all this wide world as it does here in the United States of America. Be clear-headed, practical men and women capable of facing facts as we find them and judging reformers, internationalists, and warmongers in the scale of results rather than in the scales of promises. Once the European chancelleries are notified through the passage of a neutrality act that we in America refuse to supply men, munitions, and money to fight their ever-recurring wars, then and not until then will Chamberlain, Delage, Mussolini, Hitler, and Stalin, and the rest of them sit down at a common table to discuss their common needs for the purpose of arriving at an agreeable peace and of abandoning the fiction of a forceful gold aggression. If history has taught us one important lesson, it is this. European wars never settled anything and never will settle anything as long as they are conducted upon the basis of sustaining the status quo of exploitation. History has also taught us that the peace treaties which concluded every European war were notorious for their force and notable for their lack of justice. That is why they've been scraps of paper as they should have been. And that is why they've been breeders of bigger and better wars. In 1914, European diplomats who were puppets of the oligarchs of wealth sounded the trumpets of patriotism and beat the drums of war. But in 1914, it was well known that the victims of war, for the most part, would be the young, unschooled men who fought in the trenches. In 1939, there is not the same readiness to declare war on the part of the diplomats and their financial overlords. Oh, the oligarchs in London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, and Moscow, and in every other capital, are aware that the 1939 style of front trenches will be their palaces and their front lawns, upon which destruction will rain down from bombing planes, destruction with its poison gas and disease germs. Destruction not for the young men in the trenches, but destruction for the diplomats, the aristocrats, and the financial oligarchs who support economic aggression and create war. To summarize, therefore, what I have said, remember what a small portion of this world Europe is. What a tremendous population lives upon its soil. What a perpetual struggle for existence is necessitated by reason of an economic system which is maintained to protect the great empires who, with bayonet and gun and gold, conquered more than one quarter of the world's territory. Remember that the gold nations insist that trade be carried on through the medium of gold, or else starvation. Remember that the law of self-preservation, which from the beginning of time until the end of time, will always agitate the oppressed to rise in rebellion. More than 20 years ago, we Americans were deceived by the sanctimonious references to democracy. Instead of making the world safe for that ideal form of government, we made it safe for depression, safe for the old economic system, which has been flooding us with bonds and debts, with poverty and financial slavery. As much as we dislike Hitler and his persecutions, as much as we detest Stalin and his atheism, as much as we are out of tune with England and France and their imperialism, which subjugates more than 400 million people in Asia, we Americans of this generation are convinced that our place is in America. We are determined that it is our business to fashion a foreign policy which will keep us absolutely free from European and Asiatic entanglements. My fellow Americans, I am absolutely convinced that the common people dwelling in Europe do not want war. They detest war. Monuments of its destruction surround them. But what is difficult for us to understand is why certain leaders in America are courting a world war even before it happens. They seem to be disappointed because Mr. Chamberlain signed the Munich Peace Pact. In fact, that was the signal for some of us to cast aside all traditions and to begin playing the game of might is right on the other side of the English Channel. Moreover, since 1937, we, the most peace-loving nation in all the world, have witnessed our official spokesman parading a vocabulary of belligerency which matched anything either Mussolini or Hitler or Stalin ever enunciated. In October 1937, Mr. Roosevelt intimated that there was danger of European aggressors coming to America to destroy us. What absurdity. Referring to what was happening in Europe, he said at Chicago, quotes, "If those things come to pass in other parts of the world, let no one imagine that America will escape, that it may expect mercy, that this Western Hemisphere will not be attacked," unquote. It was on that occasion that he invited us to cooperate in quarantining the dictator nations. Following that speech, we began to ask ourselves, what of the League of Nations? What of the World Court? Did not the American people and the United States Senate once and for all settle those questions? Did the Chicago speech mark the passing of our ancient traditions of no foreign entanglements? Was Uncle Sam about to become the policeman of the world with the hope of restoring law and order and justice on the other continents at the very moment when our own country was suffering from more lawlessness, more disorder, and more economic privation than at any other time in its history? It is true that in 1937, the flames of passion were beginning to burn fiercely in Europe. It is true that every informed man and woman in America knew how wicked the peace treaty of Versailles was, that it kindled those flames of passion. Was not the Chicago speech then the opportune place, and was not 1937 the opportune time to invite the European leaders to undo the harm which resulted from Versailles? Or was it the proper place and time to add oil to the conflagration? Following Chicago, there was occasion for the president to visit Canada. Speaking in the name of the people of the United States, Mr. Roosevelt said that if Canada were attacked, the United States would not stand idly by. Now, why obtrude such militaristic thoughts upon a peaceful people? And who in the name of common sense can attack either Canada or the United States, 3,000 miles distant from Europe and 6,000 miles from Japan? Then came the president's message to Congress in January of this year. He said, quotations, "Words may be futile, but war is not the only means of commanding a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. There are many methods short of war, but stronger and more effective than mere words, of bringing home to aggressor governments the aggregate sentiments of our people." Unquote. What methods did he mean? The boycott? Although Germany and Italy choose to live under a different form of government than the one which we sustain, what unjust aggression have they made against the United States? Not as much as Russia did, against whom we implemented no boycott. Every person understood whom President Roosevelt meant on that occasion, because his spokesman, Senator Key Pittman of Nevada, some days before this message to Congress, officially informed America that the people of the United States did not like the government of Japan, nor the government of Germany, nor any form of dictatorial government, communistic or fascistic. Well, certainly, we American people do not like the government of Japan or Germany or of England, for that matter. We do not like them in the sense that we like our own better. And finally came the warm spring speech as Mr. Roosevelt was terminating his spring vacation. "I will be back in the fall if we don't have war." How many Americans are aware that according to our Constitution, it is not the business of the president or any other president to determine our foreign policies? That's the business of the United States Congress. Was it the United States Congress that said that we would back European democracies against dictatorships? It was not. Nevertheless, at this late hour, Mr. Roosevelt is making an historic effort to maintain world peace. May he be successful. But now I ask you, what is the reason for all this war talk in America? Why are we so interested in protecting democracy when there is none? Why are we so determined to preserve the status quo of the peace treaty of Versailles, which every person recognizes as unjust? Why are we so anxious to meddle in European affairs when we have great difficulty in handling our own affairs? Pause, my fellow Americans, to recollect that the disaster which is about to overwhelm Europe is of Europe's own making. A small territory overpopulated with teeming, starving masses. 425 million persons exploited by an unjust economic system predicated upon gold and operated by the oligarchs of finance. Then why should America or Americans become party in perpetuating such injustices? Why should we forsake our own problems and sacrifice our own youth, our own wealth, and our own property to sustain a status quo to which the common people of Europe themselves are opposed? If America went to war to help preserve it, it would be a war against the people. Why, therefore, should we consider writing a neutrality act which will permit our President first to name the unjust aggressor and secondly to sell arms, munitions, and airplanes to the nations against whom he deems the aggression had been committed and thereby incur the enmity of the other nations? Such a neutrality act necessitates war. If we serve notice, therefore, upon Britain and France, upon Germany and Italy and Russia, that in no way will we participate in their continental affairs any more than we will permit them to participate in our continental affairs, there will be no worldwide conflagration. Meanwhile, Washington is filled with the representatives of the propagandists who talk of peace and democracy and who desire war and dictatorship. Representatives of more than 4 million members of the League for Peace and Democracy, which is wedded to communism. The same organization which petitioned Congress to lift the embargo in Spain. The same organization, this League for Peace and Democracy, which applauded the slaughter of Christians in Spain. All these propagandists are active. They are intelligent. They are resourceful. And above all, they are in league with the Bolsheviks, whose main desire is to keep America in turmoil, to inject America in war, and to see American democracy vanish in the smoke of destruction as it has in every other country. And I challenge you then by asking, what opposition can you offer to them? The officials of the League of the Peace and Democracy, the front men for the warmongers. Will you permit them to proceed unchallenged under the banner of peace and democracy? Peace that means war, and democracy that means Bolshevism? If I know the American public, and I think I do, if I know the American public who fought the League of Nations propagandists, who defeated the World Court radicals, who triumphed over the reorganization Bill advocates, I am sure that once again the Paul Revere's will ride, and the steady-going American men and women will rise to action this week and next week, in defense of George Washington's principle of no foreign entanglements. There is still the United States Senate with whom these forces must contend, a Senate safeguarded by the Constitution of our nation. With your moral support, my friends, it was this United States Senate which kept us free from the World Court and the League of Nations. It was this United States Senate which kept us from lifting the embargo against Spain in favor of the communists. And it will be the same United States Senate which will succeed finally in passing a neutrality act. That will be a neutrality act, and therefore in nullifying the policies of hate, of bloodshed, of dictatorship, of Bolshevism, and of world war. Erasing from our hearts all animosity towards all people, English, French, German, Italian, and Russian, and towards all races, Jew and Gentile, let us contribute our part towards formulating a policy of world peace by minding our own business. Let it be a peace established upon the firm foundation of justice, not upon the quicksands either of financial or commercial aggression, not upon the possession of tons of gold. To accomplish this objective, under God, stand by the Senate, and the Senate will stand by you. In addressing a letter to a group of students who asked some enlightenment on European conditions, Senator William Borah of Idaho recently said, quotations, "It was the democracies of Europe which wrote the secret treaties by which all the spoils were divided even before the World War was closed. It was the democracies of Europe which wrote the Versailles Treaty, not a peace treaty, but a spoils treaty. It was the democracies of Europe which for 20-odd years refused to make any change in the Versailles Treaty looking towards peace. These European powers continue, Senator Borah, whatever may be their idea of ideology or political views, pursue one and the same course when they come to deal with international affairs. They all alike violate treaties, disregard the most fundamental principles of right, pursue methods which inevitably lead to war, and then call upon the United States, Canada, and other nations to save them from their own intolerable and vicious methods." Unquote, Senator Borah. My friends, I have every reason to maintain confidence in our United States Senator. There are many more of the same caliber as Senator Borah, whom I have just quoted. Possibly they may be influenced by the filthy propaganda of the warmongers. But more probably, I am certain that they will be influenced in behalf of peace if you and your neighbors take time to write a letter this week imploring them as your representatives to stand by the Constitution insofar as it is the business of the Senate to determine our foreign policies and to write a neutrality law which will keep America free from all foreign entanglements. My dear friends, that is the conclusion of this address. I humbly ask you to be considerate of your fellow Americans. I humbly implore you to play your part in keeping America free from European intrigues. I pray God that He will fill your heart this day with sufficient enthusiasm to write a letter to your senator. Next week may be too late. Next week, we may be on the highway to war. God bless all of you. God bless Europe and America too. And keep us following the pathway of the Prince of Peace, taking us far from that course marked by the Prince of Darkness. I shall be happy, my friends, to mail you a book of 13 discourses containing the past 13 addresses I made over this microphone. Good afternoon. God bless every one of you.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Father Coughlin, May I thank those stalwart men and women who have volunteered to act as distributors of Social Justice Magazine. Without them, and without the hundreds of thousands of subscribers, this publication would not be possible. Every week, its pages carry information bearing upon the vital subjects which concern all of us. No advertising matter is carried, because its editorial counsel, Father Coughlin, feels that without advertising, he and the editors of this publication are at greater liberty to give expression to their thoughts. In conclusion, may I once more invite you to write for a copy of the last 13 addresses delivered by Father Coughlin over this microphone. They are compiled in a well-bound book, which is yours free for the asking. Anxiously awaiting your verdict, the question, will Father Coughlin continue broadcasting throughout the summer months? A verdict which only your letters will decide this week. May I invite you to join us next Sunday at this same hour over these same stations. This is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the policies of this station. Your dial is set at 1,250 kilocycles. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.